Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Stephen Nadler. He is the V.S. Research Professor, the William H. Hay Professor of Philosophy, and Affiliate Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about his book, Spinoza, A Life, second edition. Stephen, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book. This is an amazingly well-written history of Bento Spinoza. Just for the benefit of the audience, he lived from 1632 to 1677. Moral philosopher, political and religious thinker, social critic, and I love this, grinder of lenses, failed merchant. I mean, he was one of the greatest philosophers of his time, but also one of the greatest philosophers. But he was considered radical and controversial, especially in his time. The depth of the research for this book was amazing. How long did it take you to write this?
I think about 4 or 5 years. It really was a matter both of, you know, going through his philosophical works again and then collecting as much as I possibly could on the background, the context of his life, his education, and then the subsequent career. But it was just fascinating research to carry out and situating myself in 17th century Holland.
Wow. Now, this is a second edition. What changed from the first edition?
A few more documents turned up. People working in the archives discovered a few more things. I did have to fix a few mistakes, I will say. between the first edition and the second edition was 20 years almost, and my understanding of his philosophy changed. That's the great thing about Spinoza. It gets more difficult every time you read him. You come to it with new questions, things you thought you understood, you realize you didn't really understand very well. So some changes there. I was able to add a little bit more detail about his younger days and especially his time as a merchant. Scholars like Jonathan Israel and other historians had discovered new interesting facts about his activities, about the Jewish community, and so on.
Well, we're going to be talking about the Jewish community in Amsterdam and also up to his excommunication, because we can't possibly do this book justice. The book begins with March 30th, 1492, and Spain expels its Jews. Why?
The reconquest of this territory by the Christian king and queen, Ferdinand and Isabella, from the Muslims, they decided they wanted to have a Christian kingdom. And a pure Christian kingdom did not really have room for Jews and Muslims.
I was going to say, we've expelled the Muslims, we might as well expel the Jews?
Well, they hadn't really expelled the Muslims yet. That was part of the general order in 1492. And both the Jews and Muslims were told either you convert to Christianity or you leave. And they did give them, the real option to leave. Those who stayed, the Jews were called conversos and the Muslims were called Moriscos, and they stayed ostensibly as Christians, although we know that a fair number of them continued to practice Judaism in secret. But those who left, a large number of them went to Portugal. And we can infer from the fact that they didn't stay in Spain and convert that they wanted to continue to practice Judaism. And so in 1492, there's a large migration of Spanish Jews into Portugal, as well as other places around the Mediterranean.
Well, it was quite a vicious expulsion, too, because they burned synagogues. They sometimes just killed people outright. And sometimes they sold them to Muslims as slaves. Was Portugal that much more a liberal country at the time?
It's all relative, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, the thing is, within 4 years, the Portuguese king, in order to placate the Spanish monarchs, issued his own expulsion, convert or expulsion order, except he didn't give them the opportunity to leave. He said, you all have to convert, period. And so there was a large number of Jews forced to convert in Portugal around 1496, 1497. A fair number were also able to leave, and they went to North Africa, they went to France, Jews were not technically allowed in France, but these were, France was not yet the unified kingdom it would soon become. And so they were able to establish themselves in places like Rochelle and Nantes and elsewhere, although still had to keep a very low profile. Some went to Italy, some went to Salonika. But there were a large number now of conversos in Portugal. The problem is that within a few decades, the Portuguese had established an Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition didn't care if you were Jewish. It cared if you were a bad Christian. And a lot of these converted Jews, these conversos, were suspected of continuing to practice Judaism in secret. And so both the Spanish and the Portuguese Inquisitions came down very hard on them, which only increased their efforts to leave.
Now, from Portugal, you mentioned some of the places that they went, but some Jews went to the Low Countries as early as 1512.
Right.
Antwerp, and then over to Amsterdam. What was the appeal of Amsterdam?
Well, Amsterdam was much later. They were all those provinces in the 16th century were still technically a part of the Spanish Empire. And so the Inquisition had authority there. So even in Antwerp, where most of the conversos, there were no Jews who went to the Low Countries yet, because you couldn't be Jewish in the Low Countries because it was still Spanish. But most of the conversos who went to the Low Countries to get a little bit farther away from the Inquisition, even though it was still Spanish territory, they went there because it was good for business. Antwerp was the most important cosmopolitan port in Northern Europe. And these were merchants who had broad trading networks around the world, and so they could continue doing business in Antwerp with probably a little less harassment by the Inquisition. Amsterdam did not enter the picture till later in the 16th century, in 1580. So the Dutch provinces, Holland, Utrecht, and even some of the Flemish provinces revolted from Spain in the mid-16th century. Spain recaptured quite a number of the southern Dutch-speaking provinces, but the seven Dutch provinces in the northern part of the territory really had now significant degree of independence, but it would take 80 years of war until 1648 till they became an independent republic. But with the start of the Dutch Revolt, a lot of the conversos who were in Antwerp moved to Amsterdam because the Dutch had blockaded Antwerp in their part of their revolt. And so this 1585, when Spain reconquered Antwerp from the revolt, that really was the beginning of the end for Antwerp. And so a lot of these converso merchants saw, well, we could do a lot better in Amsterdam, and maybe in Amsterdam we could also return to Judaism. So in the final decade or so of the 16th century and the first couple of decades of the 17th century, there was a large influx of conversos from Portugal, from Antwerp, and from elsewhere into Amsterdam. And so we have the beginning of a Jewish community in Amsterdam right around the turn of the century.
What's amazing is, having read your biography of Frans Hals, Holland, although a lot of people talk about the Golden Age, the Dutch Reformed Church had all sorts of its own problems that it was dealing with. And how did the Jews figure into that?
Well, on the one hand, they were kind of outside the fray because the internal problems of the Dutch Reformed Church pitted conservative versus less conservative elements, the so-called remonstrants and then the counter-remonstrants. And so there was a great deal of turmoil within the Dutch Reformed Church. And so if the Jews kept their heads down, they could probably avoid some of the mud being slung back and forth. But many of the counter-remonstrants who were more conservative Calvinists would like to have seen the Jews expelled as well. And so they were quite concerned with the outcome. And for a while, the outcome was in the hands of the conservatives. In 1618, they got the upper hand of the Dutch Reformed Church. But I think the Dutch also recognized that for good economic reasons, they should not expel this community, which was making a significant contribution to the economy. So there was always opposition, but for the most part, they were relatively safe.
Now, for the Jews in Amsterdam, many of them were merchants and brokers. What else did they do?
So they were doctors. They were professionals. They were limited in what they could do because the guilds were closed to Jews. So, for example, they couldn't join the Painters Guild or the the guilds that governed many of the crafts. They couldn't be part of the government. They couldn't. They weren't citizens. You could buy citizenship, you couldn't be a citizen if you were Jewish by birth, or you couldn't inherit it. So, as citizen rights go, they were fairly limited. But you know, the Sephardic Jews, at least the Jews from Spain and Portugal, were many of them were quite well off, and they assimilated to some degree in Dutch ways. They started to dress like the Dutch, unlike the Ashkenazic Jews who would later come from Eastern lands fleeing pogroms. The Ashkenazic Jews are much poorer, but they are also much more learned in Jewish ways because the Portuguese and Spanish Jews had been cut off for so long from Jewish traditions and Jewish texts. So it was a really interesting split between these two Jewish communities in Amsterdam, and there was no love lost between them. In fact, when the Ashkenazic Jews started arriving in Amsterdam, the Sephardic Jews were somewhat embarrassed by these poor beggars.
Right.
A good deal of the charity within the Sephardic community was used to send them back to where they came from.
What I found fascinating was the role of Venice in the life of Jews in Amsterdam.
Yes, Venice had a much more well-established community.
So they supplied the rabbis.
Some of the rabbis, yes. They were also a source of authority. So in the early decades of the Amsterdam community, when there was a dispute, they often sent to Venice to get advice on how to resolve the dispute. Rabbinic advice, but also communal advice, how to organize things and how to take care of unruly members.
Now, life was concentrated in very well-defined neighborhoods. But as you mentioned, as you write in the book, they were not ghettos. They were just the Jewish quarters.
Right. They could live anywhere they wanted in the city. They just happened to live in this particular neighborhood because it was a relatively new neighborhood. The city was expanding physically. And so there were spaces available, homes available here for rent and also for purchase. But it was also, interestingly, this neighborhood was the center of Amsterdam's art world. And so the main street, which was called the St. Anthony's Graestraat, the St. Anthony's Broad Street, was home to many artists, art dealers. Rembrandt lived there for a time.
And you speculate in the book, is it possible that Spinoza knew Rembrandt?
It's possible. I don't think it's likely. You know, there's no probably safe to say that they passed each other in the street. But when Rembrandt was living in his house on the Braestraat from 1639, if I remember the date correctly, to the late 1650s, Rembrandt was a young boy, then an adolescent. Oh, sorry, Spinoza was a young boy and then an adolescent. He was not yet the philosopher. He was just another merchant. And so there's no reason why Rembrandt would have taken any special interest in him.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Stephen Nadler. He is the Vilas Research Professor, the William H. Hay Professor of Philosophy, and Affiliate Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking about his book, Spinoza, A Life, second edition. I love the details that you write about life in these communities. What were Spinoza's parents like?
Well, we don't know very much about them. So his father, Miguel or Michael, was a merchant, and his business was importing dried fruit and nuts, mostly from around the Mediterranean and the islands off the coast of Africa. His mother was Michael's second wife, and she died when Spinoza was quite young. We know barely nothing about her. We know about her family background. And both Michael and Hannah Deborah, that was his mother, were born in Portugal. So they were immigrants into Holland. And so they themselves had gone through the Converso experience. When Hannah Deborah died, Michael married again a woman named Esther. And he had, Spinoza had a couple of siblings. But we really don't know very much about Michael, even less about Hannah Deborah.
Now, the Jewish neighborhoods were known for having a high standard of education. And you talk about the Talmud Torah. Can you just talk about that?
Sure. This would soon become, by the mid-17th century, a well-known Jewish educational society throughout Europe. And people would send their kids to Amsterdam to study there. It was begun fairly early in the history of the community. And because of I'll use the term wealth, you know, compared to the richest of the Dutch, these were not really wealthy people. But there was enough money to establish both a school and an educational society. And by the middle of the century, or even earlier than that somewhat, Amsterdam was training its own rabbis. And the seminary there, the yeshiva for rabbinical training, became famous. Until that happened, though, because they weren't able to produce their own rabbis, the community had to bring in rabbis from across Europe, from Fez, Morocco, from Salonika in what's now Greece, from Italy, from Venice, Salve and Matera, because these would be rabbis who were never cut off from Jewish texts. They were learned, and they were able to teach these conversos who are now returning to Judaism what it meant to be a Jew and give them lessons in Jewish traditions and normative Judaism, how to keep a Jewish household, how to worship in the synagogue, and so on.
One of the fascinating things about your book that we're going to talk about now is what led to Spinoza's sort of radical education and then his eventual excommunication. And you talk about a person named Uriel da Costa, who was a radical. And among other things, he denied the immortality of the soul and a lot of other things of Jewish tradition. And is it pronounced a harem?
Harem. You have to put a little more throat in there.
Harem. Okay. And that's a serious thing within the Jewish community. What is it?
So, let's first talk about da Costa. It's true he was a radical and declared a heretic both in Venice and Hamburg and confirmed in Amsterdam. I don't think he personally played any role whatsoever in Spinoza's turn towards philosophy and radical ideas. He was, according to what we know, da Costa killed himself in 1640 when Spinoza was only 7 or 8 years old. But he was himself a converso. And when he returned to Judaism, he was a little unsettled by what he saw Judaism had become. He was expecting it to be the Abrahamic religion of the Bible. He really had no familiarity with what had become of rabbinic Judaism over the centuries. And so eventually his unorthodox views earned him a harem, several harems, in fact. Now, harem is, technically it means putting something out of use, separating it. And it could be that you're separating something that's sacred and that's not to be used for everyday use, like, vessels or something. But it could also be something that's separated because it's cursed. And eventually, even in the rabbinic period, a harem was used to separate people who had become heretics, who were cursed. And what it meant was that you were ostracized, and it was unlike Catholic excommunication. It wasn't just a liturgical thing; it was social, economic, very personal. You not only could not be called to the Torah in the synagogue, you would not count as part of a minyan or prayer quorum, but also you couldn't participate in business with other members of the community. You couldn't engage in everyday social conversations. You were outside of the community. Typically, a harem would, in Amsterdam, there were a lot of harems issued because this was a community that was trying to really establish normative Judaic practices. And so they used the harem as a way of keeping things kosher, so to speak, probably more than any other community in Europe at the time. And you could see that a harem was attached to a large range of offenses in the community's regulations for things like insulting a rabbi, taking a book out of the library without permission. A woman would be put under harem for cutting the hair of a Gentile woman. You weren't allowed to do that. Sexual relations between Jews and Gentiles were punishable by harem. Lots of different offenses, unsavory business practices. There's one case where the text that we have lots of documentation from all these harems. One says a certain individual is put into harem for circumcising a Polish man without permission. And we can only hope it wasn't without the Polish man's permission.
So, we got to get to this point before we run out of time. Spinoza is put under a harem. And that's one thing. But the viciousness, the vehemence of the harem to read was shocking to me. Like, I'm just going to read two lines. The fury and zeal of the Lord will burn against this man and bring upon him all the curses that are written in this book of the law. And may the Lord erase his name from under the heavens. And it goes on. It goes on. That's amazing. So, Stephen, when I read the transcription of the harem that you put in this book, it shocked me. What did Spinoza do?
Well, that's a great mystery. We don't really know, because the harem document, and you're right, it's absolutely singular. Most of the harem documents of this period are relatively brief. They simply say this person is under harem and no one should talk with him or deal with him, period. And then
now this was read aloud in a synagogue, right?
In Spinoza's case, it was, yes.
Shoot.
And usually a harem would be lifted after a couple of days. All the person had to do was apologize and usually pay a fine. Spinoza's text is long, as you said. It's full of curses and damnation. But all it says is for his abominable heresies and monstrous deeds without telling us what they are. So on the one hand, there's this great mystery. What was it that Spinoza had done? And scholars have put forth various proposals.
Some people said it was the machinations he was doing to relieve himself of debt, and that was an embarrassment to the community.
Yeah, I don't buy it. I think that would have earned him a harem, but nothing with this litany of curses.
No.
I think we should take seriously the idea that he was punished for abominable heresies, and that's a matter of ideas. And Spinoza himself had told witnesses a few years later that he was kicked out of the synagogue for saying that God exists only philosophically, for denying the law, that is, rejecting Jewish law, and for saying that the soul dies with the body. So I think, and if you read his mature philosophical treatises, which he began within just a decade or less than a decade of the harem, there's really no mystery, because if he was saying anything around the time of the harem like what will appear later in his treatises, then there's really no mystery here. These are not the kinds of statements about God, about Jewish law, and about the soul that could possibly have been tolerated by a 17th century Jewish community.
Was Van den Enden, I think that's the name, Van den Enden, Spinoza studied with him. Was he a tremendous influence on him and sort of push him into these more secular beliefs?
It's possible. I mean, he was technically his Latin tutor, but also introduced him, I think, to classical literature, maybe also to contemporary philosophy. One of the things that Spinoza scholars like to do is try to figure out, what turns Spinoza into Spinoza.
Yeah.
And we could point to Van den Enden, or we could point to Descartes, because he started reading Descartes' philosophy in the mid-1650s. Or was it the people he was hanging out with? Was it his own imagination? But I think a very good culprit here is the city of Amsterdam. I mean, this was a really cosmopolitan, tolerant, relatively liberal city where ideas flourished, literature was available that would not be available elsewhere. And the spectrum of religious and political views that were circulating in Amsterdam, that's the kind of thing that would turn a young mind into radical thoughts.
But what happens to a person when a harem is issued, especially one of such vehemence, was issued? I mean, do you become, anathema in the neighborhood?
Yeah, that's exactly what you become. You're persona non grata. And in many cases, the most cases, I think, from the period, the person reconciled themselves to the community. But in Spinoza's case,
after that, when you read the full context and you reprint it in your book, there's no going back from that. There's no.
Right.
I'm working my. You're damned in the cosmos.
Yeah, it's over.
It's like, it doesn't get much worse than that.
It does, it doesn't hold out any hope for it. It doesn't say, well, until he pays the fine or apologizes. And,
no.
I think Spinoza's response was, fine, I was leaving anyway.
Did it affect his later philosophies that this happened to him?
It had to have. I mean, this, no matter whether he had really lost his faith or desire to belong to the community or not, it's a fairly traumatic event for somebody who is born and raised into a Jewish community and educated within that community. It had to have. And in his theological political treatise, which he published in 1670, but began writing around 1665, so less than 10 years after the Cherem, he has very harsh things to say about Judaism and about organized sectarian religion generally. But he comes down pretty hard on the Jews. And, one thinks it's going to be a reflection of the way he felt he was treated.
And therein lies the rest of the book. We've only sort of talked about the first third of the book. My returning guest tonight is Stephen Nadler. He is the Vilas Research Professor, the William H. Hay Professor of Philosophy, and Affiliate Professor of Art History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we've been talking about his outstanding history and biography, Spinoza, A Life, second edition. Stephen, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me again, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.